Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Movie Geeks United this Wednesday evening. Have a great show planned for you tonight. Lloyd Kaufman, filmmaker extraordinaire. Over 40 years, Troma's been going strong, and he's had a career that's made an indelible impression on the film industry overall and on so many of the talents that we cherish in generations since he started. And we also have the 2011 Nickel Fellowship screenwriting winner with us tonight to discuss his screenplay in an upcoming reading that will occur this weekend in Texas. And we'll talk about Elizabeth Taylor, who just passed away earlier today, one of the last great movie stars we have from that era.
I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, it really is one of the last, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Speaking of not so great, I just saw that movie, Skyline.
You poor thing.
Tonight. Ugh. Ugh.
Yeah.
It's like, I have no idea why the studio would greenlight something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty, Yeah, it's not even good bad. It's just bad. And like you said earlier, it makes Battle Los Angeles look classic in hindsight. And that's what I did. I did, you know, while watching Battle Los Angeles, yeah, this is light years ahead of Skyline. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But yeah, Skyline was just really bad.
Yeah, it really, it very much is. And I mean, there's no awe in it.
No.
Which, if you have a big budget alien invasion movie, there needs to be some awe inspiring kind of destruction, and that's what you look for from a big budget studio kind of thing, you know?
Right.
Nothing like that here.
Nothing.
And I didn't feel there was with Battle Los Angeles either.
Right.
I mean, these movies make Michael Bay look great.
You know, give us a couple of months. Let's hear what we all say about the next Transformers movie. So,
yeah. But I did. I have been watching this other movie that I discovered called Tenderness, which is a Russell Crowe movie from 2007. It's really intriguing. It's a Sundance on Demand kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
A movie I knew nothing about. I'm halfway through it, and I still don't know anything about it. I love movies like that. That I love going into movies cold.
Right.
And you're able to do that less and less now because we're so bombarded with marketing, and we know every step a movie takes before we walk in the theater. You know, it's so when you go into a movie and you have no idea what to expect, that's a special gift.
That is. That really is. I guess, what did I watch? I watched on demand on Saturday night. We watched Monogamy with Rashida Jones and Chris Messina.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I didn't know anything about the movie. I just knew.
Not to be confused with Mahogany with Diana Ross.
That's exactly right. I was thinking the same thing. Thank you.
Were you?
No wonder I was having trouble Saturday night. No, and you know, it wasn't what I expected. It went it went in some ways that I didn't really expect, at least from reading the description of it. So yeah, I like that. But you're right; it is harder and harder to do that in this day and age.
Yeah, and I think that people are lazier for it too. I find that a lot of people want to know everything that they're about to see before they buy a ticket, which on one hand I understand because
right.
tickets are so darn expensive for a lot of people nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, are they programmed to be lazy?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they lazy and that's why they're susceptible to that kind of marketing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is the whole big corporation scheme, and we talk about this somewhat with Mr. Kaufman,
mm-hmm.
is that changing us, or is it just responding to our natural
state?
Yeah,
I have a confession to make. You know, a lot of times people will post, I haven't really in the last like year or so, or a couple of years, I don't really seek out much information anymore. I don't know whether it's burnout or I want to be surprised. But like, you know, you played some of that trailer for Bad Teacher a couple of weeks ago, like just audio
mm-hmm.
clips of that. And I never bothered to find the trailer online or anything. Then we went to go to the movies and they showed a trailer for it and I couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah.
I was just on the floor, but I was glad because, like, if I had never seen that trailer, and I just remember I was like, "What the hell is? Oh, this is that movie. Oh," and I was just on the floor, man. I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, it's like,
yeah, it's a funny trailer.
I hope the movie's funny, but
it's
yeah.
the same thing with news, with gossip, and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I mean, what if the quote unquote respectable news organization stopped gossiping? Would
right.
we still, would we tune out, or are they feeding us what we want, or is it the only diet we're being given, and so we just accept it?
We kind of just accept it, but I know what you mean. When you mean gossip, though, what do you mean exactly? That's, I guess, like, you mean like the celebrity, like tabloid kind of things, or?
Well, it's indiscernible. There's no, like, clear line between the two now.
Well, that's true.
I mean,
yeah.
everything's kind of celebrity now.
It is. Everything is celebrity. And, you know, it's like both, everyone's sort of at fault in that now, because we also have this other thing the last couple of years, Twitter, where celebrities of all sorts interact with, you know, with fans and with media and everything. There's almost like, well, you almost cut the actual, like, the news organizations out almost in that way. But, the problem with Twitter is, while I think it's great to talk to, you know, if that really is a person or their assistant or whatever, the mystique has been taken away, if there ever was any mystique. But that's, you know, the wall has sort of, like, fallen. But there are a lot of different ways. I know what you mean, though. It is the tabloid, the news and the tabloid. It's all, like, sort of been put into Cuisinart lately, and there is no separation, really.
Yeah. Well, yeah, something to ponder, you know, when you're done listening to tonight's show.
Sounds good to me, man.
You know, they cast HBO has this Game Change
mm-hmm.
movie.
Oh, yeah.
About the election, the last election. And so Julianne Moore was cast as Sarah Palin a couple of weeks ago, and they just announced today that Ed Harris is playing John McCain. So, good casting.
It's
so
great
far.
Casting.
Yeah.
It's super, superb casting, but, I mean, these people don't deserve this quality actors playing them.
Yeah.
That's a horrible thing to say, but...
HBO is just unbeatable in terms of kind of the caliber that they attract for their projects.
Mm-hmm. No,
this is more proof of that. I can't wait to see how the rest of it fills out.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you cast as Obama?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that. Well, not Fred Armisen, if that's what you mean. who would I cast?
I don't know.
That's a tough one. Who would you cast as a sitting president? I mean, you got Josh Brolin to play W. That's a good question. Who would you get to?
Who else is involved? I mean, it would be John Edwards. But John Edwards, Sorkin's doing his own movie about
mm-hmm.
John Edwards. And I don't know if that's, I think that's a feature film. I don't know if that's connected with HBO. I don't think it is. He's got a show on HBO now, so.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. Something for our chat room to ponder.
Chat room, please.
Yeah, if you have any ideas about who should be cast as Obama in the upcoming HBO movie, you can email us, too.
Yeah, there you go.
If you care that much,
if you're
email
really,
us,
if this
please
is something
do.
That's keeping you up at night.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to our first interview, our mm-hmm. star interview for the evening. And right after this interview, we'll actually be playing a clip from our star interview on Sunday night show, Mr. Malcolm McDowell. So we'll give you a little preview of that one as well. But Lloyd Kaufman is our star for tonight. And what a star he is. He's, like I said before, he's made an incredible impression on the film industry. With the history of his company, Troma Films, he's produced and directed hundreds upon hundreds of films, supported some terrific filmmaking talents along the way, and given us classics like The Toxic Avenger and Class of Newcomb High and Tromeo and Juliet and Poltergeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, and just beloved films that people can watch over and over and over again. These movies have stood the test of time. And he's actually about to start his Troma Dance
right.
Film Festival. And this year it takes place in New Jersey. It takes place April 22nd through the 23rd. And the film selection at this festival isn't the only unique thing about it. It's also quite unique because it's free. I mean, it is a truly independent, democratic, completely open and welcoming film festival for people that just love movies, and they have all kinds of movies that are playing there. If you click on the link on our website here, it'll take you directly to the website, tromadance.com, where you can read all about it. But for right now, here is Lloyd Kaufman talking to us about his extraordinary career and what it means to be an independent filmmaker now, and the Troma Dance Film Festival. Here's Lloyd.
You've been a big part of my life for a long time, your films, so this is a great honor.
Do you have a favorite Troma movie?
I do, actually. I was talking to, you know, my mom about it earlier, Class of Newcomb High.
Oh, that's great, because the whole theme of Class of Newcomb High is sort of being replicated in an island country that begins with J.
At
this very minute.
Not me.
And what's very interesting is we've had three companies and three big, giant, evil corporations that want to remake Class of Newcomb High because of what's happened in the island beginning with J. So that gives you a sense of what the movie industry is like.
Well,
very cynical.
Very cynical. But so quick. I mean, that's really quick. That
three different companies. Yeah, isn't that something? Yeah. And but the Class of Newcomb High is a good movie. It's a very interesting film. I agree with you. And has a lot. It's a classic. I agree.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's so interesting.
You know, that brings up something that I actually want to ask you about, which is so many of your films deal with kind of political, socio-political themes. In a very subversive way. That was all part of the game plan from the beginning for you?
Well, it just reflects my politics. I had a grandmother who was very, very, very left-wing, much more so than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to send me a lot of stuff when I was a kid, and I.F. Stone Weekly and Carlos Lamont and Scott Nearing and
mm-hmm.
William O. Douglas. And I used to read all this stuff. And C. Wright Mills, there's a professor at Columbia named C. Wright Mills who wrote a book called The Power Elite, which basically talked about the military-industrial complex
right.
and all that stuff. But I sort of reduced that to, or not reduced it, but transformed it into the conspiracy of the labor elite, the labor leaders who make millions of dollars while their constituency are eating dog food. the bureaucratic elite, the Congress, and the corporate elite. And these three elites suck dry the little people of Tromaville of their economic and spiritual capital, and the little people of Tromaville need someone to save them. Sometimes the Toxic Avenger has to come in and save the people of Tromaville from the evil elite conspiracy, or Sergeant Kabuki Man NYPD, or sometimes, as in Troma's War, the little people of Tromaville take matters into their own hands and save the First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. Boy, am I boring. And this is terrible.
You're incredible. But yeah. these crises that you're talking about, I mean, they're
the Jesus crises? Now, wait a minute. Jesus Christ, leave him alone. He is our Lord and Savior. As a dirty Jew, I command you. Don't
the crisis.
About crisis. Oh, the crisis. Crisis, yes. What crises are we talking about?
All of them that you're talking about, they're worse than ever before.
It is pretty amazing what's going on now, isn't it? We're going to bomb Libya now for some reason. What is that all about?
How do we do that? How do we get it? You know, this is something that's right up your alley, like with your films and everything. It's like it's surreal almost. We're fighting, it looks like, a third war on like credit, borrowed credit. You know, it's not even our money we're fighting these.
What is it? What are we? In other words, what is the rationale for bombing Libya? I didn't quite understand, because I heard something about, well, Gaddafi is killing his own citizens. But didn't China bomb and exterminate the Tibetans? We didn't bomb China. And didn't the Russians exterminate a lot of Chechens and Jews? And we don't bomb them.
Yeah.
There's a whole thing on the Today Show and all these shitty, horrible morning shows about bullies. We're a bully. We're bullying. If we can beat the crap out of them, we'll do it. And the New York Post and the Daily News, our New York papers, are making fun of the Gaddafi. They have headlines, Kaboom, K-H-A, boom. You know, but we don't go after the Russians or the Chinese. That's interesting, isn't it? Have you seen that movie? What's that movie with the little machine in the space? Wall-E?
Wall-E, yeah.
We're the humans in that movie.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I don't know if I'm right, but I'm drunk. No, forget that. It's the crack speaking. It's not Lloyd Kaufman, it's the crack. Anyway, let's talk about art and trauma dance.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about, I definitely want to ask you about trauma dance, but about the independent film as it is today. Is the independent film kind of a fallacy now? Is there such a thing, really, outside of what you're doing?
Well, fallacies are very important in my films. I think the fallacy is very serious. As a gay married man, I am extremely interested in the fallacies. But I think that independent cinema is terrific, because there has been a democratization of the making of cinema. In the same way that when cars were invented, you had to be really, really rich to own a vehicle, a car, rather. But then comes along Henry Ford, who then suddenly democratizes the ownership of cars. Well, thanks to the digital revolution, anyone can make a movie. The art of cinema has become democratized. The problem is that the distribution channels being able to live off your art has become more and more difficult, because the media has become so consolidated, and the rules that used to protect the public against monopoly have been done away with, so that even though anyone can make his, her, or its own movie, or its own damn movie, like my books, the problem is, no matter how good your movie is, if you're not aligned with one of the giant devil-worshipping international media conglomerates, you can't get to the public. And that's the conundrum, and that is the tragedy. There are great, great, great independent movies all over the world that are being made, but because we are in an age of Adam Sandler with his movies on 6,000 screens, we miss a lot of really good subversive cinema. And my movies are totally blacklisted, economic blacklisting. My films are not you know, my films I think are important, but there's a pant load of much more important movies that are could be changing the world for the better, and nobody gets to see them because we are living in an age of the conspiracy of the labor, the bureaucratic, and the corporate elite.
Right.
But the video has dwindled. What avenues have you sought out to get your work seen?
We've got nothing. We're totally, the only reason Troma is still around is we have fans who bust their asses to find our movies. We have the Cannibal the Musical, Trey Parker and Matt Stone's movie. You know, they have a Broadway show now.
Right, yeah, the Book of Mormon.
The Book of Tro Mormon. I saw it last night. It's a very good show, and it's quite good. It's very, very good. And it's better. I would say it's better than Cannibal the Musical, but Cannibal the Musical is pretty close. And Cannibal the Musical has never been on American TV. It's a huge success on home video. Never been on American TV. It has no nudity. What's the excuse? It's Troma, therefore economic blacklisting. Toxic Avenger. The Toxic Avenger Part 4, Citizen Toxie's never been on TV. That sold more DVDs than Cannibal the Musical, and it's never been on American TV. This is economic blacklisting. We have never, ever, in our almost 40 years, we've never had a movie in Blockbuster. We've never had a movie at Walmart. We've never had a... It's economic blacklisting. If you're not part of the club, you are riding the back of the bus.
But let me ask you this. You say when you mean American television, do you mean cable television as
anything with a small screen that's not DVD.
Oh.
Cannibal the Musical hasn't even been on MTV, hasn't even been on Comedy Central.
Okay.
South Park is the biggest asset.
Right.
And Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4. Sold, I think, 300,000 DVDs. Never been on any kind of American TV.
But wasn't there, you'll forgive me if this is a mistake on my part. Wasn't there, I think, in the 90s, wasn't there some a Toxic Avenger television show or
there was a cartoon show in the 90s.
Cartoon.
Yeah, but that 90s was 20 years ago. Buddy.
I know. I realize. I just didn't that bring in another avenue of fans, if you would. You also had toys.
Sure, it brought in a lot of fans. It didn't just bring in a lot of fans. It brought in a lot of air conditioners, too. Let me tell you. Damn it. But the point is, we have a huge number of fans. But if we are blacklisted and we can't get on to any... If our fans cannot find our movies, we're dead. We're dead in the water. Our fans... Troma is lucky because Troma is a brand. And our fans are fighting to see. They will go to the Troma website to buy Citizen Toxie or Terra Firma or Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead.
Right.
By the way, Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead opened in New York City in one theater, and it was the highest grossing screen in America. And yet, 2 weeks later, it was kicked out. Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead was kicked out of that cinema because... Indiana Jones skull fucker had to own every cinema in the world.
Right.
They had to be
in
every screen, even our crappy little screen. So, that's the problem. You can't fight City Hall. I mean, we can fight City Hall. We've been around for 40 years, but that's because we are sort of a cinematic herpes. We won't go away.
But I would imagine that's why you're probably also very passionate about your film festival. I mean, this is an avenue to get these movies that are outside on the fringes before an audience.
Well, Trey Parker, Matt Stone, and his group, and I, during the Cannibal Musical, formed the first time it was made, we all went out to Sundance, not because I wanted to go, but because they wanted to go. I went with them to ski, and I was horrified by how ugly the Sundance atmosphere was. And Trey and Matt and those guys also were actually equally horrified, and they that led to setting up our own little festival, and we would put on Troma Dance. We started, I think, in 1999 or 2000, and we organized the Troma Dance Film Festival in the same town as Sundance and at the same time as Sundance. And there was no, you didn't have to pay, you don't have to pay to submit your movie to Troma Dance.
Right.
And you also can go to Troma Dance for free and see the movies. And there's no VIP policy because Sundance is the opposite of that. Sundance is elitist. They make the poor filmmakers pay to submit their movies, and then you have to pay to see the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, maybe pay $5, $10, but some of those tickets are very hard to get and very expensive. And Troma Dance, everything is free. So we had, for 10 years, we had Troma Dance in the same town and at the same time as Sundance, and but everything was free. And then we kind of outgrew Park City, Utah, which is where Sundance is. And last year we moved to Asbury Park, New Jersey, which is the home of the Toxic Avenger, of course, and Tromaville, New Jersey. And, you know, it's kind of takes it's a little more, the Troma Dance has grown a bit, but it's still totally free. Everything's free.
It's very inclusive. I mean, it's...
A lot of people wonder, is it all horror films or no? Troma Dance has got children's movies. It's got, last year it had the premiere of A Human Centipede. It's got everything from G-rated to pretty much X-rated movies. It's a very interesting festival and totally fan charged. It's all volunteer, and the only reason to be at Troma Dance is that you're a film fan. There's no, it's not like networking, or there's none of this, hoity-toity stuff, or
right.
networking, or let's make a tax shelter stuff. It's all about the love of cinema, and hopefully giving movies that are very idealistic and independent a shot at getting some people to see them.
And it's a 2-day event.
Yes,
and it's this year. It's April 22nd through the 23rd.
There's a website, tromadance.com, tromadance.com. And this year we have some interesting guests. We got Bill Plimpton, who's a wonderful animator, and he did that series on MTV called The Head. He's been nominated for an Academy Award. And he's one of our, and he has actually distributed his animation independently himself, and now there's a whole movement of animators who are distributing their own animated movies themselves because Bill led the way and has been doing it. He's a seminal filmmaker,
mm-hmm. and he's someone that has been influenced by you. I mean, I've heard quotes from him that you were a very key influence for him.
Well, I'm happy to hear him. I did not know that, but I'm happy to hear that. Anyway, he's a good guy, and he's incredibly talented, and I'm glad that he doesn't hate me for being influenced by him. It didn't ruin him.
Before I let you go, I just have to know about you've been doing this for so many years.
For so many years? Masturbation?
How do
you
filmmaking.
Know?
You've been doing that longer. But
that's
filmmaking.
Well, that's when you're independent and you have total control and you're doing everything yourself, there's a little bit of masturbation involved. It's a good metaphor.
It is.
Yeah.
But if through all the kind of battles that you've been through, that some of which we've mentioned tonight, what keeps you going? Is the love of filmmaking still as strong as it was when you first started?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's an art form, and there's no purpose to be in that field without having a love of the art form. I mean, there are easier ways to make money, and mm-hmm. and indeed. We have made some money, but that isn't what it's about. It's about exposing your soul and doing things you believe in and things you love, and working with people that you love and that you respect, and also stirring the shit a little bit. And unfortunately,
right.
I tend to, I think if I have an Achilles heel, it's that I tend to stir the shit more than I should. You know, that turns me on a little more than creating good art, and that is a that may be the difference between Oliver Stone, who started with me, and me.
Mm-hmm. We need more shit stirs. Let me
yeah, we do.
I actually miss fields too.
But yeah,
I miss Oliver Stone, the shit stirrer. Actually.
Yeah.
Well, he started with me, and he's unbelievably talented. And now we just finished a film that I didn't direct, so it's good, called Father's Day, and there are six directors on that up in Canada named Astron Six, and it's excellent, and it's controversial, and it makes some good political points, and it's trauma-esque, but sort of trauma of the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So keep
mm-hmm.
an eye out for Father's Day. It's being edited now.
Oh, cool.
And I think it's pretty cool. And meanwhile, I'm trying to write, I'm working with the third set of writers on Toxic Avenger Part 5. So hopefully, it takes me
That's
a long
cool.
time to get a script that I can believe in. And I think that's what's important about this. It's an art form. And unless, at least if you're going to be independent and do it the way Trauma is doing it, you have to have something you really believe in, otherwise there's no purpose in it, because you
mm-hmm.
know, Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, I'm totally proud of that movie, and it's, you know, the New York Times and Entertainment Weekly and all of the underground blogs love it, but it will never make a penny. But you know, over time it will. Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, Stephen King discovered it and put it on his homepage, and you know, all sorts of people love that movie, and we'll never make 10 cents from it. But that's more important, really, than, you know, making Eat, Pray, and Love.
Right.
Yeah.
That, because you'll forget about that, and your film will last.
Well,
your
you
film will have a
Class
life.
Of Newcomb High. Class of Newcomb High was made in 1986,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
it's still... You know, we even though it's in no, you know, we have no distribution anywhere, the Trauma website still sells a huge number of Class of Newcomb High
mm-hmm.
DVDs. What? You know, I mean, and it still gets theatrical bookings. My new book, Sell Your Own Damn Movie, talks a bit about that and how Fair Game, this movie Fair Game or whatever, you know, we already forgot it. And yet,
mm-hmm.
Class
mm-hmm.
of Newcomb High, 25 years later, is still in movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm proud of that, even though I'm wearing a cardboard belt and sleeping in a refrigerator box out near the railroad station.
Well,
where are you guys
well,
located, by the way? Are you in part of New York somewhere?
Actually, the show number is out of New York. It's strange. I'm in Florida. Jerry's
oh,
in Maryland.
Okay.
In
where
Maryland,
in Florida?
Yeah.
Where in Florida?
Between Tampa and Orlando. And
do you go to MegaCon? Do you go to MegaCon? Because Trauma has a big presence at MegaCon, which is a big comic book and American pop art, pop culture event.
Where and when does that take place usually?
I think it's this weekend.
Really?
Trauma has a huge booth there in Orlando, at MegaCon, yeah. And it's a lot of fun.
Well,
you
I got
check
something
it out.
To do. Now I have something to do this weekend.
Yeah.
I can go up there to MegaCon.
Cool.
You've just livened up my social life.
Well, I'm sure they would love to. I'm sure the convention would love to have you guys do a report on MegaCon.
Oh, we'll be delighted to do that.
Yeah.
And Trauma has a booth there, and Shane Swenson is running it. A guy named Shane Swenson. He's running it.
Mm-hmm.
And Toxie and the Traumettes will all be there, and it should be a good time.
Yeah.
Well,
and,
I'll attend. I appreciate
And what about
that.
Maryland? Where are you in Maryland?
Silver Spring.
Oh. You're near you're not far from Baltimore.
I'm closer, actually, like really close, more closer to D.C. than I am Baltimore.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Like right next to, right next to the city of corruption and everything.
Well, I go down there. I'm chairman of the Independent Film and Television Alliance, which is the trade association for independent industry. And I go down to, we have a lobbyist in Washington, and we go down to Washington to, put a monkey wrench into the Comcast merger or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we've had a little bit of traction. You know,
that's good. No, that's very good with that.
I spend a little time in Washington. And,
yeah.
And I have a daughter, actually, who's working, Lizbeth. Have you seen Trauma's War? By any chance, Trauma's War? If you haven't, you must.
A long time ago,
you should check it out.
Yeah,
Trauma's
it's a
War.
Good movie. It's good.
It's one of my favorites, but it's one of the most obscure of the films that directed, and it's so prescient. It dealt with the terrorism and all that stuff. But there was an 18-month-old baby in that movie who was kidnapped by terrorists, and Lisbeth, that baby was Lisbeth, who was also a mutant daughter later on in Romeo and Juliet. Well, anyway, she is in Washington, D.C., working for the Center for American Progress, John Podesta's very open-minded think tank. And if you go on Twitter, at Lisbeth Kaufman, you can read. She's been writing very interesting articles about green science and futuristic stuff. And I just put up an article. She did something by Kurzweil. She did a piece on Kurzweil, this futuristic guy who has a book that just came out called Testament Man, and how knowledge and science are proceeding faster than the brain, and blah, blah, blah.
Right. No. This rings about, I remember you actually in a previous interview talking about this.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember this from a couple years ago.
That's right.
That's
the way I am.
No,
I wish
great.
I could
no,
remember.
It's wonderful.
Unfortunately, I can't remember it because I took a lot of acid.
Well, you're doing better than a lot of people who don't take acid, okay?
Those were the 60s, yes.
Let me tell you that. You're doing a lot better than a lot of people who don't do any drugs. You're doing a lot better than they are, so.
Well, thank you. The Toxic Avenger is still, you know, it's being remade now, by the way, speaking of the good old days. Akiva Goldsman, do you know him? Akiva Goldsman.
Yeah.
Terrific.
He wrote Dangerous Mind and got an Oscar for that.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. All right, you say it's being remade. Now, do you see anything from the remake?
Shit, yeah. Assuming we get, we're supposed
sure
to get some humongous checks. That's how we're going to make Toxie 5.
Okay, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's
and
good.
Stephen Pink. They've got Stephen Pink, who directed and wrote Hot Tub Time Machine and High Fidelity and Gross Point Blank, all of which are good, wonderful films. So he's writing it and I assume will direct it. So maybe it'll be, you know, they're spending $100 million supposedly. So you know, maybe it'll be a good remake. You know, there's no reason you don't go to movie jail for making a good remake.
That's true.
I actually saw a letter that you wrote on your website to fans that were critical of the idea of a big budget remake.
Yeah, they were angry. A lot of our fans, they set up a Facebook, don't remake Toxic Avenger, and then they had another Facebook, Lloyd Kaufman should direct the remake of Toxic Avenger. And I got them to take down the Facebook about me directing, because clearly I'm not the guy to direct a $100 million mainstream movie. I don't think I'd want to.
Right.
But there's no reason not to remake it. If nothing else, it keeps us in business. We can make Toxie 5, and it might be good. What's wrong with that? And then there's always the original, you know, the original Toxic Avenger is still there.
Right.
Nobody's taking
that
down. That's absurd.
See that. Let me ask you a question, though. Just, I don't mean to keep you on.
No,
you are doing something. Would you be willing to, for like Class of Nukem High, Surf Nazis Must Die, and the other, Terra Firma, would you be willing to sell the rights to remake those in order to finance more films on your end?
Terra Firma, I think, is an amazing film, Terra Firma. When I look at that movie, I can't believe we made it. It's so out there. I can't imagine anybody remaking that movie.
Well, no, I mean,
you'd
be amazed if they remake, obviously.
I'm just amazed it got made. I'm amazed we did it.
Right.
You know, the fact that we had I don't think I would do that film. I mean, it's so out there. I'm amazed that I must be totally insane, because that movie is really nuts.
Yeah, it is a nice movie, but
it's the most personal movie I've made, and I really bared my soul in that movie.
Like what John Carpenter's done, and he's been criticized for, like, basically selling off his whole entire library to have it remade. Would you be willing to? Are you willing to do that with, some, like, let's say, the Class of Nukem High or something, so that you can finance your own movies? More original work down the line.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
And who knows, maybe the remakes will be good. By the way, my brother's movie, Mother's Day, has been remade. I have not seen the movie, but from what I hear, it was at Cannes Film Festival. I hear it's Rebecca De Mornay stars and Jamie Hill is in it, and I hear it's really good. I was in Germany not too long ago, and on a tour there, and one of my hosts said that they had seen it, that he had seen it at Cannes and thought it was, almost as good as the original. So who knows? There are a lot of good remakes.
No, there are. There are good remakes. It's not, and there, you know, it's something that people think is a recent phenomenon. There have been remakes as long as there have been movies.
That's right. Absolutely.
People don't understand. You know, Ben-Hur was a remake of the silent Ben-Hur, and so forth.
Well, how about All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? How about The Star is Born, Judy Garland?
Yeah.
That was the third iteration, and it's the best one. How about James Gunn's script of... James Gunn worked for Troma and went on to write Romeo and Juliet.
He also wrote that book, the book with you, All I Need to Know.
He sure as hell did, that's right.
Yeah.
And now he... Well, at any rate, he did Dawn of the Dead, the remake. That's a terrific movie. That's a scary, friggin' zombie movie. And, of course, Zack Snyder may have had something to do with it, but
right.
James's script is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff up on the roof where they're playing chess or whatever it is,
that's
all James Gunn. That's brilliant. He's got a new movie coming called Super.
Super.
Yeah, we're very excited to see that.
I star in that movie, by the way. I didn't know if you know that.
That I did not know, but I'll be definitely looking out for you.
Well, you have to look fast. I'm on screen for about 1 second, but I'm there.
Well, we'll look out for it.
And I also film behind the scenes. I've got a book coming out called Sell Your Own Damn Movie, and I interviewed Ted Hope, who produced Super, and I filmed for the DVD box set of Sell Your Own Damn Movie or Produce Your Own Damn. I can't remember which one, but one of the box sets, I filmed James Gunn and Ellen Page and Rainn Wilson and all those guys. And so it's an independent movie. It's just a movie at the top end of the independent movie.
Right.
But it's a crazy movie. You're going to like that one. It's really good.
We're actually going to offer links for our listeners to purchase your Make Your Own Damn Movie set and a couple of your titles as well.
Oh, thank you.
So how many titles are there? I mean, I have All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, I Learned from the Toxic Avenger, and then there's Make Your Own Damn Movie. And
these are the books. Yeah, Make Your Own Damn Movie is a very good book. And then there's Direct Your Own Damn Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Produce Your Own Damn Movie, and I've just turned in. I'm doing the final proofreading of Sell Your Own Damn Movie, which I think is the best one of them. But it won't be out till May, I think.
Okay.
But all those other ones are out, and there are box sets. Direct Your Own Damn Movie box set. Like the book, they go very well together because the Direct Your Own Damn Movie book is kind of half my own kind of theory about directing and how I've done it, and then the other half of people like Eli Roth and Roger Corman and Joe Dante, and they're successful directors.
Yeah.
So you can half the book is devoted to a flop, me, and then the other half, if you want to be a flop, you can read my half, and if you want to be successful, you can read the other half of Direct Your Own Damn Movie. It's your choice.
But
you're far too self-deprecating.
Yeah, you've
been doing this for so long, and you still have that fire in the belly. And how many people can you say that about? I mean, it's
admirable.
That's
true. Yeah, well,
and a lot
of
the people you just named, if it wasn't for you, they couldn't exist.
Well, certainly Barack Obama would not be bombing.
Yeah, that's true.
We haven't seen Troma's War. But Trey Parker and Matt Stone are still very loyal to Troma. You know, those guys are totally nice to us. And most of the people who've worked for us, they put me in their movies. Neville Dean and Taylor, who did Crank and Crank 2 and Gamer, and I'm in their movies. And just little cameos. But that's to me, that is very touching, I don't really care about the Oscars and any of that stuff.
Right.
I'm into making. I just enjoy the fact that I've been able to have some freedom, and also the fact that you guys are interested. How cool is that? You guys are interested in Troma, not because Troma's advertising in the New York Times, but because you're sincere fans, and how cool is that? That you know, The Adam Sandler movie gets a two-page story in the New York Times, not because anybody in the New York Times likes Adam Sandler. It's because they're advertising, and Rupert Murdoch or Paramount or whoever is involved, you know. And I'm not saying Adam Sandler isn't talented, but, you know, everybody knows his movie's coming out because $60 million of advertising is advertising it. You don't need the New York Times to talk about it. But the New York Times does because they need the advertising and they're on the needle.
Right.
So you
right.
guys have nothing to gain by interviewing me. In fact, you probably have lost every listener you've ever had.
No, there's probably a huge amount of silence. You're worse than I am when it comes to self-deprecation, okay? You really are.
But those movies, I mean, if I have to talk about
another... I do self-defecation, and that's...
Yeah, well, there you go.
You ain't seen nothing till you see that.
Oh.
I just had
some
enchiladas
tonight.
I might
have something to rival you on that.
I just had a couple of enchiladas. There's going to be some amazing self-defecation very soon. Actually, I'm doing it from the mouth right now.
You are the human centipede. That's great.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, that is Lloyd Kaufman. His Troma Dance Film Festival takes place April 22nd and 23rd in Jersey. To read more about it, you can go to tromadance.com. So we thank Lloyd very much for giving us so much of his time.
Yeah.
And being such a great, warm, very funny guest.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Sunday night, we're airing the first part of our Malcolm McDowell interview, where he's going to discuss his new film, A Pound of Flesh, and some of the other highlights of his career. The other part of the interview will air during our third episode of our Kubrick series covering A Clockwork Orange. Obviously, that part of the interview will concern his work with Stanley Kubrick. But I wanted to give you guys a preview of what to expect Sunday night. Here's a little clip of Malcolm discussing his work with Robert Altman in the film The Company.
Just to work with the man, now, I was friends with him. We're going back to 1970. We hung in London and we're naughty boys together. And we always laughed. And we'd always get together. I mean, if we found ourselves in the same city, he'd show up. He showed up, you know, when I was doing Caligula in Rome and stuff like this. Just hilarious stuff. Going, hey, kid, I got to come down and see this set. A lot of naked women out here. I mean, yeah, and guys, too. He goes, oh, okay. So, you know, we'd have a good laugh. I just love the guy. And anyway, I was doing, at the Lincoln Center, they showed this movie I did called Gangster Number One.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Altman was in the audience for the Q&A, and I went, oh, my God. I went, everybody, one of the greatest directors ever is sitting right here, and I have to say, will you just wave? It's Robert Altman. And people applauded him, and he waved. Anyway, we went to dinner afterwards, and he looks at me, and he goes, can you dance? I went, can I dance? God, how old do you think I am? I went, no, hell no, I can't dance. He goes, I'm doing a little dance movie. He goes, anyway, I don't need you to dance. I went, okay, whatever.
So that's just a snippet of the upcoming interview on Sunday night with Malcolm McDowell. So, Elizabeth Taylor passed away earlier this morning at the age of 79. A great star of a classic era. What is your, what would be your most memorable Elizabeth Taylor screen role?
Probably Giant. Giant in the VIPs would probably be my most, but I also, you know, obviously the two Lassie movies she made, we always watched those as kids, but really, like, for me, it's like Giant, the VIPs, A Place in the Sun, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and, I mean, everything she did with Burton was just, like, golden. The Comedians, even Cleopatra, which by today's standards, I think, I don't even think we can really call a disaster anymore. It's, you know, if you go back and actually watch the movie, it's actually really... decent epic, and it's also just cool to watch the two of them.
Right.
One of the funniest things is that they got married, they got divorced, and then they got married again. And it's just fascinating. They were fascinating to watch together. But she was just, you know, she was always, I gotta hand it to her. She stayed in the game as long as possible. And I really got to hand that to her. That's a very hard thing to do. And her charity work, obviously, is her heart had no bounds whatsoever. The stuff that she did for AIDS and everything was incredible. But, I mean, she was really, I mean, child actress, and she really got better and better. I mean, there's no denying that. There's very few people today I can think of that have really had that kind of stamina and can last. And
well, her heyday was the 60s, obviously. She said
right.
that she 50s and 60s, but she said that she didn't even attempt to act until what was it, A Place in the Sun.
How old was she in A Place?
I mean, she had done movies previously, but she started taking acting seriously on that. Well, how old was she when she passed?
Yeah, we heard today it was
79.
19. Oh, no. How old was she in A Place in the Sun, though, when she made...
Oh.
I heard it was 19, that she was 19 when she made that.
Yeah.
That's incredible. But, you know, I think what did my mom tell me that she was one of her earliest roles? She was one of the children, the orphans, in the orphanage, in the A Jane Eyre. She had, the range, the filmography is just astounding when you look at it. You go and look, it's just, wow.
Yeah.
You can't help but be in awe.
Yeah, absolutely. And her favorite role of all of her own, her favorite movie was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
That's a crazy film.
Crazy
play. You gotta love it. It's just like, that whole thing is on fire. That's just brilliant.
That's as intense as it gets right there.
Yeah.
And Mike Nichols. I mean, man, Mike Nichols made some groundbreaking stuff. Now,
yeah,
Virginia Woolf, Carnal Knowledge, and Graduate, and yeah. So, Cleopatra is an interesting story. I mean, the whole troubled production behind that, and she was the highest paid actress at the time with $1 million fee.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I remember I was on a plane and I picked up a Vanity Fair. Earlier this year, and there was an article in there about the great love affair between Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and how it continued after their second divorce, and he was with another woman towards the end of his life.
Right.
And I guess he wrote her a love letter, something like the night he died, and she always kept it in her... and her dresser right next to her bed, and she said she never revealed what was in the letter.
Right.
But a great roller coaster, passionate, tumultuous relationship, and really one of the first of what we were talking about earlier in the show, the kind of gossipy thing, but they were the first kind of power couple.
Yeah.
In a way. Mm-hmm. International attention that couple got.
You're right.
The Hollywood Reporter listed 10 of her most unforgettable movie moments. So if you guys are looking to check out some Elizabeth Taylor classics in the next few days, and I think that Turner Classic Movies is actually having a Elizabeth Taylor festival like on Saturday or something. They're playing all of her films, a few of her films. But the Hollywood Reporter's list includes The Taming of the Shrew from 1967, Franco Zeffirelli. She starred opposite Richard Burton in that. National Velvet, that's what made her an instant star.
Yeah.
Giant,
yep.
Alongside James Dean and Rock Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly Last Summer.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Tennessee Williams, who she also got back to Tennessee Williams with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
That's a great version of that. That's an incredible... I mean, I like also there was a TV version made with Sam Shepard and Jessica Lange that I like a lot. But that one with Newman and Taylor is just incredible.
Mm.
A Little Night Music. This is 1977. It's a Harold Prince film where she played a famous actress who seduces a married man.
Mm-hmm.
A Place in the Sun. That's 1951. That was her child star to adult movie siren kind of transition that she made opposite Montgomery Clift. Cleopatra. Butterfield 8.
Mm-hmm.
She won her first Oscar for playing the prostitute.
Right.
In Butterfield 8 opposite her then husband Eddie Fisher. She won her second Oscar for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Mm-hmm.
And she won a humanitarian Oscar in 93, I believe, too.
Mm-hmm.
For all of her
yeah.
charitable work.
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth Taylor is gone. Okay. We have one more interview, but anything else going on? What comes out this weekend?
Oh, this is the Sucker Punch weekend.
Oh, so this is the weekend I won't be going to the movies.
Yeah, this weekend you won't be going to the movies. It's Sucker Punch, and then next week we have Source Code, so there's some interesting stuff coming. I think Super comes out next week, but I'm not positive.
Mm.
But I guess so. I'm the only one of the three of us going to see Sucker Punch. Okay. All right. Well, I'll have something to say on Sunday.
Tree of Life. Will it be
it
at
is.
The Cannes Film Festival?
It will be. I thought that
well,
was
thank, official. Thank you for drawing out that suspense.
Well, I okay, never mind.
And the answer is... It will be.
It
Thank
will.
You. what they don't know is if it will play in or out of competition.
Oh.
Yeah. But it will be a Cannes Film Festival.
All right.
That'll be good. So we'll see some advance. Well, not too advance because it comes out in May anyway.
But mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some advance word of mouth on that. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, I can't wait. It looks fascinating. It really
and
does.
And the trailer for Captain America came out today, too. So if anyone's interested, it's out there. It's waiting for you.
Yeah, I still haven't watched it. No, I want to see the movie.
Anyone?
I haven't watched it.
Yeah. Not one that I have a great amount of faith in.
Well, there's a really interesting article in Wired magazine, a new issue of Wired by the writer Neil Pollack, and he basically echoed what we had been saying on the show because he was talking about the Avengers and how the build-up to it and using these movies essentially as advertisements for it. He had criticized Iron Man 2 for basically doing that. And he basically thinks that Thor and Captain America are basically throwaway films as far as he's concerned because they're really just setting this big film up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been going on lately, people writing about that. So they really are just almost like two-hour plot points to get to the Avengers movie. That's a lot of money to just build up to something.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily see Captain America being a very successful movie.
You're going to have Green Lantern, Captain America, Thor this summer. That's three, there's
this
burnout.
Summer.
There is burnout, and if that happens.
Super exhausted of superheroes.
Yeah, I mean, and next summer you have... you have obviously people are curious about the Spider-Man reboot, but it's really all about the Dark Knight Rises. That's
mm-hmm.
really the big one. So, I don't
Akira.
Know.
Akira is being adapted into a live-action film by the Hughes brothers.
Oh, they're going back to that. Okay.
You know who wrote the script?
Who?
For this? Steve Kloves.
Really?
Didn't Steve Kloves, wasn't he the one that did... Men Don't Leave and Fabulous Baker Boys and Flesh and Bone?
I think I'm not positive on that, but wow, if that is the case, well, yeah, I'm all about branching out. I mean,
Yeah, but he hasn't directed a movie in forever. I mean, Flesh and Bone, I think, was the last one he did.
Wow, okay.
You remember Flesh and Bone?
Yeah, that's Gwyneth. Isn't that the movie that made Gwyneth got noticed, right?
That's right. Gwyneth is in it. And
James Caan.
Dennis Quaid. Yeah.
And Meg Ryan. That's an interesting movie. I mean,
it is interesting, yeah.
But let me look this up on IMDb right now. Let me just look.
To make sure it's Steve Kloves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's odd that he stopped directing, I think. But they're approaching Robert Pattinson, Andrew Garfield, and James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Garrett Hedlund, Chris Pine, Justin Timberlake, and Joaquin Phoenix. They're looking through that pool for the two leads.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're really going for, that's like all top shelf. Wow. But that is, I mean, that's every hot.
Robert Pattinson in Akira.
Yeah, well, the Robert Pattinson, you know, let's see how this Water for Elephants is. This could be the film that breaks him out of the, because I haven't read the interview in Vanity Fair, but supposedly he's just like really goes off on the Twilight movies in this interview. But he's sick of talking about them. But no, Steve Kloves, he's the screenplay for all the Harry Potter movies.
Oh gosh.
Okay, and the Amazing Spider-Man for next summer.
Oh gosh, really?
Yeah. Wow, he's been writing. Holy smokes. Wow. All right.
But he hasn't directed anything since Flesh and Bone, right?
No, Flesh and Bone and the Fabulous Baker Boys are the only things.
Well, that's like 93 or something.
Yeah, so.
Hmm. Interesting. Is Leo having any involvement in Akira? Not to my knowledge.
No.
Leo's involved in everything.
Right, but I don't. They have been talking about this for a very long time.
And I take it you're talking about Leo DiCaprio. Not Leo McCarthy.
Fitzpatrick. I like Leo Fitzpatrick, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, Leo's got the J. Edgar Hoover that he's shooting right now. Leo's attached to Scorsese's next movie. I don't know. And a few other things that I hear Leo's attached to. I just want Scorsese to make The Irishman, damn it. Put off, you know, and because Scorsese's my favorite director, but he rarely makes movies that I look forward to beyond the fact that he is directing them. Mm-hmm. Like, if I just hear the plot synopsis for a lot of his movies, I'm like, if he wasn't behind the camera, I wouldn't be that interested. The Irishman is absolutely one that I'm interested in, as was The Departed and Casino.
Right.
Silence, story of two monks.
Is that still going on? Is that still being?
That's what he wants to make right now. Now that he's done with Hugo Cabaret, he wants to do Silence, and that's what De Niro said. De Niro said he wants to make Silence before he makes The Irishman. But then he's got The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio that he just announced.
Right.
Then he's got the Sinatra project that was announced last year for him.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of stuff before The Irishman.
Well, yeah, and I don't know if all that's happening before The Irishman, but the point is, I mean, he's in his 70s. I mean, it can't all happen.
No, let's skip everything else and get to The Irishman.
Exactly. Pesci, De Niro, and Pacino all together. And Keitel, you know, I was watching the Blu-ray of Taxi Driver, and I have my problems with Keitel, but that's one of his great performances, Taxi Driver.
Oh, he was great in those Scorsese. He was great. I mean, he's been good in a lot of things, but he hasn't lately. He just hasn't. There hasn't been a role for him, it seems like, in a while. I mean, he was doing some great stuff in the 90s. Smoke, Reservoir Dogs, Bad Lieutenant, City of Industry, The Young Americans. And then, you know, after, well, I mean, his voice is in Inglourious Basterds. That's about it. But I haven't, I mean, the movie, I mean, he made the one that.
And that's the best performance of all. I'm just not crazy about Harvey Keitel. But, I'm glad you mentioned Smoke, because Smoke is actually not only something I love to do, but it's a movie I love.
It is. It's a great movie that no one talks about at all.
Always love that movie.
Yeah.
And it's a joy of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And not just like storytelling in terms of the structure of the screenplay,
mm-hmm.
storytelling as people tell stories on
right.
screen.
Yeah.
And it's such a kind of gentle, human
mm-hmm.
movie. I just love it. It's Harvey Keitel and William Hurt. And
mm-hmm.
it's got a great cast. Now, the Blue...
Dr. Banning's great in that, too.
Yes, yeah. The Blue in the Face,
mm-hmm.
Which was the unofficial kind of sequel to it,
right.
isn't nearly as good. But Smoke is great. So if you haven't seen Smoke, check it out. It's,
yeah.
it's got this great closing story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. That's,
yeah.
that's awesome, the story, yeah.
Yeah, I love that movie. But thanks
Wayne
for
Wang,
reminding me.
No, Wayne Wang's a great... You know, I was looking through all these movies like the last couple of nights on like Chinese Box, and he's made a lot of good movies. You know, I don't know what he's done recently, but he's a fascinating director. But
Wayne
Smoke, what was that? But Smoke is one of those great lost films in the 90s that no one talks about anymore.
Right. I have a Wayne Wang story, and actually, it is my I'm not going to say what you think I'm going to say, but I was going to say something just as awful. It is, I don't know if I've ever told you or shared this on the show.
Okay,
and it's completely embarrassing.
Okay.
But okay, I'll do it.
You do it, please.
My most embarrassing moment in life actually has something to do with Wayne Wang. Because he directed The Joy Luck Club.
Right, right.
Right. Stop me if I've told you about this.
No, I haven't. No, I have not heard. I have never heard you and Wayne Wang in the same sentence, so please.
So, I'm in theater management at the time that The Joy Luck Club comes out. It's a weekday first matinee or whatever, and you know all the old people come out. It's like Night of the Living Dead at the theater. They come in droves. So, and they all went to see The Joy Luck Club. And I don't remember much about the movie, but I remember like walking in towards the end of the movie and sitting in the back of the house. Dark theater, a sea of blue hairs. Sitting watching the movie, and it's a highly emotional kind of reunion because I guess the girl is left as an infant to be picked up and cared for by anyone that comes across her or something, and then she's reunited with her family at the end, if I'm remembering correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not it's the emotional well of the movie, but it's very quiet moments too in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting back there and you can hear all the old people stifling and crying, and they're very
mm-hmm.
moved. And I don't know what happened, but I, all of a sudden, out of the blue, I let out the biggest fart you've ever heard.
Oh, my God.
And the whole crowd at the theater turned around and looked towards the back of the house, like, where the hell is that coming from? So I ran the hell out of there. I like locked myself in the office when
did
they all went down.
Did a car backfire or something?
I have no idea. I was shocked because I don't do that sort of
right,
thing
right.
in public. That's an embarrassing funny story. Come
it
on.
Is an embarrassing. It is embarrassing. It's very funny. I mean, hey, no, that's a car backfiring. No, it's a tree frog.
Right. So that's my Joy Luck Club. And we've just lost every single listener. Thank you.
No, man. We still got all reliable.
So Wayne Wang. Yeah, Smoke's a great movie. anyway, Wayne Wang, I thought he just signed on to do something else, actually.
He made a movie.
I thought
he was
just in the news. Cause
he was really? Well, here, let's go to the... go to IMDb and figure out what we
yeah,
got.
Look that stuff up. Wayne Wang. Everybody Wayne Wang tonight.
Let's see what we got here.
Yeah. Anyway.
There's a film coming out, a post-production of the film Snowflower and The Secret Fan, and then there's just this one that's been announced, Einstein.
Yes, that's it.
Ron Bass wrote the screenplay, and... there's no
Wayne
one lined
Wang
up
guy,
yet,
right?
But yeah. But yeah,
okay.
That's it.
All right, who would you cast as Einstein? And would it be the same person you cast as Obama?
Yes, it would be. Yes.
Matthau made a great Einstein in that movie IQ.
Yeah, IQ. Yeah. No, no, he was a good Einstein.
Einstein was also in that an Einsteinish character in that Nicholas Rogue movie, Insignificance.
That's right, he was. That's wow,
which
that's
is coming out Criterion in June.
Oh, that would be cool. That would be yeah. That'd be good. That'd be really cool to own. Let's see who Ryan Gosling
as Einstein?
No, I'm joking. But he has that he has some kind of intensity that it would be if you said that. I wouldn't like fall out of my chair and be like, I could see him doing it. But it would have to be a performance that, you know, that's not this. When you play something like this, it can't be caricature. And a lot of times, unfortunately, performances like this do turn into caricature.
Right.
So this is a hard one. Jeffrey Rush, well, maybe?
Oh, that's nice. That's a nice idea.
Yeah.
Pacino's got the hair for it. I mean,
Pacino
it's all over the
do
place.
Do it. I mean, I wouldn't rule that out.
Nick Nolte. I'm just trying to see people with like hair all over the place, like all out of
whack.
Well,
go with Gary Busey for that matter.
Just cast Phil Spector. I mean, that's all you got to do. Did you see that Nicholas Rogue movie that's been on Criterion for years? Bad Timing. It's another Teresa Russell.
I haven't seen
Russell.
It on Criterion. I watched it on cable, but I haven't seen the Criterion. No.
Yeah, there's an interesting movie.
Yeah, that is.
What do you think of Art Garfunkel?
I haven't really thought much of him in a long time. I mean,
like, where did he go? I mean, with his movie career. I mean, he did a couple of interesting films and
mm-hmm.
disappeared.
Yeah. But I know, I mean, I don't know. I haven't given him much thought lately, but yeah.
All right. Well,
I'm being honest with you. I'm not going to lie and say, oh, I think about him all the time. But... I have him on the speed dial.
I had a dream
dial.
About Art Garfunkel just the other night. It's funny you mentioned that. Here's something interesting. Let me read a top 10 list from the Criterion, and we'll discuss a little bit of these movies for about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Jane Campion. So occasionally they do like these invite these filmmakers to give their top 10 favorite Criterion titles, and we love Criterion on the show. They asked Jane Campion, and here's her top 9. Well, she cheated. She didn't go 10.
Mm.
Samurai, number 9. Samurai 1.
Oh, okay, cool.
Muchachi Miyamoto.
Those are great films. The Samurai trilogy, those are awesome.
Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Made for television, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Fellini's La Strada.
Okay.
Ozu's Tokyo Story.
Ah.
Godard's Contempt.
Wow.
Which I like.
No, these are all great films. I mean, wow.
Godard was such a smartass.
He's still
alive. He still is, yeah. So I'm sure he's still a smartass. But as evidenced in that opening scene of Brigitte Bardot, completely naked on the bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's essentially saying, I know you want to see this. And then he distorts the color in the scene. For no practical, logical reason whatsoever, but just to screw with you, to say, but you're not going to see it the way you want to see it. So pay attention to that next time you guys watch Contempt. I like that movie.
No, it's an incredible movie.
That Obscure Object of Desire from Buñuel.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
The Fireman's Ball, Milos Forman. Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa. A great, great filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And The Night Porter.
Wow, The Night Porter. Movie. Awesome movie.
One of the most perverse movies ever.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
There's the
love
tribute
that,
show.
Love that
There's
scene.
The tribute show, the Dirk Bogarde tribute show.
Yeah. That's a musical waiting to happen.
Yeah.
What's a Spider-Man thing? Mount a Night Porter musical. Especially like the creepiest scene is when the Nazi like brings her a gift at the dinner table
mm-hmm.
and it's the head
right.
the head of whatever person offended her.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a movie.
That is.
Okay. We're gonna close tonight with an interview with Andrew Landham.
He is the 2011 Nickel Fellowship Screenplay Award winner. His screenplay is called The Jumper of Maine. And this weekend, actually, Ballroom Marfa, a group called Ballroom Marfa in Marfa, Texas, mm-hmm. Saturday, March 26, will be holding a staged reading of his screenplay. So you'll be able to see the screenplay come to life with actors. The screenplay is currently in development. If you go to ballroommarfa.org/film, you can read more about this event. So we had a chance to sit down with Andrew for a few minutes to talk about his screenplay and the inspirations behind it and the feelings he has about the upcoming staged reading. And here's what Andrew has to say. What is the process like for you? Is it because I find it very painful to write. Is that in the part of the process at all for you, or is it enjoyable from start to finish for you?
I love writing, so in general, it's enjoyable from start to finish. It gets painful when you don't know what to do next. It gets even more painful when a couple of days pass and you still don't know what to do next, which happens at some point depending on the script you're working at. I'm not a fan of outlining. I try to outline and I'm learning how to outline, but I don't naturally enjoy doing it. So if I had my way, I would never have to plan anything and I could just wake up and start writing every day. And then I'd probably always be writing and always be having fun, but I wouldn't always be turning out scripts that make any sense. So I'm trying to kind of learn how to balance the two. But in general, the actual writing of it, I really, really enjoy. And the way I work is I write longhand during the day and I type up at night. And I'm a big fan of redrafting and restarting. So the actual process of it in that way, I really enjoy. I just don't like the dead period when you finished a draft or a script and you're not writing the next day.
Right, right. But for The Jumper of Maine, you're dealing with a lead character with Tourette's, as you have, like
right.
You've said. Now, were there films that you looked to with characters with Tourette's that gave off cliches that you were trying to avoid? Were you trying to do an honest depiction of the disorder that hasn't been seen before?
Yeah, I think there's not a lot of movies about. I don't think there's ever been a really great movie about Tourette's, which I think is a shame, but good for me, I guess. And in the movies that there are like one of the. There was an indie called Niagara Niagara at one point that came out, but the character was a real mess, and she was always drunk and having promiscuous sex, which I think maybe some people with Tourette's end up having problems with in their life. I don't think everyone with Tourette's is a total mess all the time. So I watched the movies with people with Tourette's or tics or things like that. But I don't think there was ever any one that was substantial enough that I could be like, okay, this is what I do want to do or I don't want to do. But
mm-hmm.
I did look a lot at kind of what the climate is around people's understanding of Tourette's. So my character has pretty severe Tourette's, but he doesn't have verbal Tourette's, which is actually only like 8% of people with Tourette's swear or repeat noises. So it's always really important to me that he didn't fall into that. And then there's a few books written about Tourette's that I reread that helped a lot. The biggest one is Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem. And I think that's the most accurate depiction of Tourette's in a fictional work that I've read.
So give me more details about the story for our listeners out there.
Yeah, it's called The Jumper of Maine. It's about a paramedic who has Tourette's syndrome. So whenever the sirens come on and it's a medical emergency, his Tourette's kind of disappears. So he's in his mid-20s, and he lives in Maine in the town he grew up in with his parents, and his mother has Alzheimer's, so she's kind of losing it, and he takes care of her with his father, and then he kind of obsessively works all the time because the sirens making his Tourette's disappear is basically his only outlet, so he's really heavily relying on that to keep him going and working throughout the day. And he mm-hmm. also had, when he was younger, his sister died in this accident, and he has a lot of guilt that's kind of increasing he's kind of using, it's like, oh, I have Tourette's and I have this problem, but it's kind of covering up the core stuff that he really needs to come to terms with in order to move on with his life. And he ends up falling in love with a single mother whom he knew when he was younger, who moves back to the town. And when he starts to fall in love with her, his Tourette's gets worse and worse because he's cut himself off from relationships in a way that he's still basically a child. And as his Tourette's gets worse, everything kind of starts to fall apart, and he ultimately kind of needs to learn how to come to terms with himself and his past and his family in order to come to terms with his condition and what he has to deal with in order to have the relationship.
So, you know, you live with this for a long time, this idea, and you're fleshing it out on page. How do you get the perspective enough to know whether or not it's working?
That's a really good question. I think initially the most important thing is that it's working, like especially when I'm a first draft or even any draft once I'm into the draft, I think it's the most important thing is that it's working. I just feel like it's working, even if somebody else isn't going to understand it. But if I feel like it's coherent and moving from point A to B in a logical manner and it feels right to me, then I'll at least be able to get to the end of the draft. And then since you're rewriting so often and you're going through so many drafts, there's probably no way that you're ever going to get it to work completely but in any of these drafts. But I feel like if you can feel it enough in your gut as you're going, that you can probably get it to a place where people can look at it and kind of pick it apart or make it fall apart in your head so you can put it back together in hopefully a stronger way. But I don't know. I think if you spend too much time worrying about whether or not, while you're actually writing it, if you spend too much time worrying about is this going to work or is somebody else going to get this, that it can kind of become a roadblock in the progress of the writing.
You'd be too concerned with kind of ingratiating yourself to the audience as opposed to being true to what you want to say.
Right, and you want to balance. I know like it's important to balance like with something that would be marketable or that you could sell and something that will make sense to people. But at the end of the day, you also need to be writing from your heart, I think, and kind of something that is hopefully true to you.
Yeah. So when did when you got a draft that you're happy with, tell me the process of finding out what you wanted to do with it.
So I wrote my first script, and then I got into graduate school based on that, and I had a summer before I moved to Texas, so I thought I should probably write a second one. And that's when I wrote my first draft of Jumper of Maine. And then over a workshop last spring, I wrote two more full drafts of it. And that third draft, a professor suggested I apply to the Nickel Fellowship and to the Austin Film Festival. And I'd never applied to any of those before. So for me, the next step was just applying to those. And I didn't have representation, and I'd only been writing for 2 or 3 years. And so then I kind of forgot that I even applied, but when I won the Nickel Fellowship, and it also won the Drama and Latitude independent categories at the Austin Film Festival, then the next step was that I have agents with UTA now, and I'm with Margaret Riley at Brillstein as my manager, and then now it has Donald DeLine attached as a producer. So the next, once it won the competitions, the next step was just kind of looking at my options and trying to go with what seemed like the wisest choice or the best gut decision for the people around it.
So your script it's been selected to be a part of this reading that's coming up. And is it Marfa, Texas?
Yeah, it's in Marfa. Yeah, Marfa, Texas, and it's put on by Marfa Ballroom. There's a number of kind of nonprofit organizations or theaters, and it's Marfa's become a real kind of booming artist colony over the past few years. And Marfa Ballroom is one of the organizations there.
And would this mark the first time you've heard a cast bringing your script to life? Or?
Yeah, well, last spring we did a reading of it in that small workshop, but it was a really small reading, and I read the lead part. So this will be the first time where I've actually seen a reading of it from outside of it.
And this is, it takes place on March 26th, the reading. How involved are you with the rehearsal period? Are you present for that?
There's some actors from Marfa, and then there's 7 actors in Dallas with the director, John S. Davies, who I think I've met a few times and rehearsed a few times. We all drive up there or fly there this coming Wednesday, and then there's 4 days of rehearsal, and I'll be there watching those rehearsals. And they've kept, Marfa's been amazing at bringing me into their, and keeping me in touch with everything that's happening and updating. But in general, during the rehearsals, I'll plan on just watching without,
right.
I don't have a strong desire to direct, especially at this point. So I'm just really excited to be able to see the process and watch it on its feet.
Okay, so the upcoming staged reading of Andrew Lanham's Nickel Fellowship winning script, The Jumper of Maine, takes place at Ballroom Marfa in Marfa, Texas. Go to Ballroom Marfa, that's MARFA.org/film for more information if you live in the area. Okay, quick De Palma news before we sign off.
Okay, all right.
Noah Baumbach is programming, you know, Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Right.
They also have a Cinematheque there. He's programming a De Palma Suspense Thriller Festival for April. Baumbach is actually interviews De Palma in the new Criterion Blowout.
Yeah, that's a
DVD.
That's definitely a reason to get that. I mean, there are a couple of sweet Criterions coming out, but that one, finally, yeah.
So in case anyone out there hasn't checked it out yet, if you go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net, go to the featured shows section, it'll be easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
We did a 5-part De Palma thriller tribute series where we paid tribute and talked to a lot of the people involved in several of these movies. But Baumbach is playing Sisters, Phantom of the Paradise, Obsession, Carrie, The Fury, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, Body Double, Raising Kane, and Femme Fatale. So all of the thrillers, really, in April. And just on a side note, that Criterion disc, apparently Criterion got a hold of Murder a la Mode, one of De Palma's earliest movies, and they're putting it on that disc as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then Obsession coming out later this year in DVD.
Sweet.
So it's a good De Palma year.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to close off with a special movie score. It should be really simple to get. I think it's one of the defining kind of music cues of the past. It will be 16 years now. It's amazing, 16 years.
Wow.
So we'll close off with that. You guys can start guessing in the chat room if you're still up. Jerry, I'll talk to you Sunday night. Malcolm
Sunday
McDowell.
Night. Yeah, dude, I can't wait to hear that. Man, that's going to be awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you Sunday night.
All right. Good night, everyone.